Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 217, I chat with video guru Joe Kane about the possible color standards for UHD TV. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 31st, 2014. Episode 217, Color My TV World. Help support Twit with your Amazon purchases. Visit twit.tv/Amazon, click on the Amazon banner, and shop as usual. That's twit.tv/Amazon. And we thank you for your support. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is video guru Joe Kane, who's been on the show a number of times, and today is here to talk about color. Specifically, what are we going to expect from UHD TV, this new upcoming standard, TV standard, in terms of color? And there's more to it than you might think. Hey, Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. And again, my apologies for the camera. We're having some issues of which camera is functioning.
Yeah, it's a weird problem, but it's okay. You're looking fine. You're sounding fine. We have a lot of pictures to show. So there's nothing really at all to worry about here as we get going on talking about color, which there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, and I hate talking about UHD and having my quality be less than standard definition.
Well, there is that problem, but yes. Hopefully those who are watching the show can put that aside. It's a few technical issues. Has nothing to do with the quality of UHD that's coming up. And in fact, we want to talk about how to make UHD as good as it can be, particularly since it's not set in stone yet, as HD is and standard def was and so on and so forth. So there's a lot to talk about. Before we get started, though, I want to make sure everybody knows that those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Joe as we go, and I will pass along as many as I can. So, as I said, we want to talk about this new UHD TV system, ultra high definition, and about the only thing that is well settled, well defined, is the pixel resolution. We have four times as many pixels on the screen with UHD than we do with regular HD, what we might call standard HD. But otherwise, the other aspects of the picture are still being debated. Dynamic range is one that we've talked about on this show quite a bit. And what we're going to talk about today is color. So why don't you start us out, Joe, with what are the choices that we have to choose from when we finally want to decide what set of colors we can represent in UHD?
Well, there is an International Teleproductions Union specification. The number of that specification is 2020. And in that specification, they said that the color space for UHD is going to be larger, in other words, more color fidelity than we've ever had in any of our television systems. The problem with what they said is, in my opinion, and a few others in the industry, the specifications they set aren't anything that can be implemented, or at least not implemented in a way that will be good for the consumer. So what's happened in color, a desire has been expressed to increase the color capability in our new future system that's being called UHD. Mm-hmm. And they set goals slightly larger than that I'm going to say that they should have. And I want to explain all that in the process of the next hour.
Right.
The most important thing of having done that is that they got a large number of people thinking that, oh my gosh, we could be doing something other than what we are doing, and we could absolutely improve this future system that we're calling UHD. So the specification opened the window to thinking about something that would do far better than what we have now. Now, if we can go to the first CIE diagram, I think it would help. Good. That's a much clearer picture. I can stand to watch it now. Right. Anyway, I think most of you are familiar with the CIE diagram. You've seen it a few times.
And those who aren't, let me just quickly make sure that they do understand it. And that this is only important if you're watching the show. I hope you are seeing the video, because we do have a lot of graphics to show you. The curved line that kind of looks like a horseshoe, you see a bunch of triangles and you see this curved line. That curved line defines the set of all the colors that human beings can see, can perceive with their eyes. And all of these triangles are different sets of color with names that go by numbers and words, and there are all kinds of different names for them. And they define a subset sometimes, in some cases a superset, of the colors that we can actually see. So that curved line is called the spectral locus. Ooh, scary word, I know, but all it means is the boundary of the range of colors we can see. And the triangles within it are the different, what are called color gamuts, or set of colors that can be represented by different systems. So I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that, Joe, before you continue.
And I appreciate that. That's a really good starting point in this. The purpose for showing this diagram and all the triangles that are superimposed on top of the CIE diagram is to give you an idea of how many options are being discussed for UHD. And you almost don't want to be bothered counting, because there's a large number of things going on in that diagram. And obviously, a larger diagram can include more colors. A smaller diagram won't have quite as many colors. And as you have already said, there are a number of triangles that are actually bigger than the visible color spectrum. They are there as color carriers. When we produce content, it turns out that you need a larger space to carry color than the actual color itself. Now, if any of you out there have ever done binary multiplication, you, first of all, you know that digital words are carried as binary words, 8 bits, 16 bits, whatever. But if you multiply two 8-bit words together, you need at least 10 bits in order to carry the result of that multiplication. Mm-hmm. So there isn't, you need a bigger space to process than the actual color space that you're working with. And of course, in production, that's what we do. We process color. So we need a bigger space.
Yeah, I always found it interesting that those few diagrams that actually, or triangles that actually extend outside of the visible color space, I mean, what do they mean? Are they into the ultraviolet, into the infrared, into the areas of the electromagnetic spectrum we can't even see? Obviously, that's not going to get transmitted and displayed on a TV. But as you say, it is used for sort of a placeholder, if you will, for the ability to manipulate those colors mathematically so that by the time they get into the visible area where we can actually see them, they represent what they're supposed to.
Well, Michael Heiss provided a very nice description of it. He said that, well, as an example, if you think of an orange juice container when you buy orange juice at the grocery store, if it's full, it's actually difficult to shake up the orange juice. If the container happens to be a lot larger than the juice that's inside, it's really easy to shake up the orange juice and get it mixed properly.
Wow, I had never thought of that, but that's a great analogy.
Michael's analogy helps you understand why you might need a bigger container if you're going to be mixing things.
Right.
And if the container is big enough, then you have room to mix them. If the container is tight in on where you want to go, there's no room to shake it up. There's no room to mix it. And that's what we do when we fade to black, or when we do crossfades, or we do color correction. We combine things, and having a larger space to contain our work means that nothing gets lost. And so those larger containers, those larger triangles, are containers that would convey information.
Got it.
Now, if we look at the 2020 specifications on, let's go to the second diagram where there aren't quite so many triangles. Okay. Thanks. This makes it a little bit easier. The largest triangle in there is the 2020 color space. It's the ITU specification for our UHD television system. And it's obviously much larger than any color space that we work in. And of course, the other color spaces that we work in are there. You can see 709 P3.
Which, by the way, 709 is the current high definition color standard. And it represents the least number of colors of any of these ones that we're talking about.
Right. It is absolutely the smallest color space. And included in here, you can see P3 in the purple. The P3 is a color space that's used in digital cinema. And so
that's the color you see when you go out to the movies in a commercial cinema.
Yes. As long as you're watching a DLP projector or an LCOS projector, you're looking at an electronic projector. Let me just not name names, but as long as you're looking at video technology in the theater, chances are the color space is much larger than the color space that we use in our high definition system. There is a third, if you look in the direction of green in this, there's a third that goes, it's sort of a green, and there's actually two on top of each other in the green. One is Adobe RGB, and I've forgotten what the other space is, but NTSC.
NTSC 1953.
Yeah. So NTSC 1953. So the green there is different from P3, which is used in digital cinema. So in this diagram, the most important thing to come out of the specification of 2020 is it's gotten people to think, okay, what should the color be? Now, mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you that because if you're already, hopefully somebody's already assuming that 2020 isn't going to work. And that's a really good assumption, at least from my point of view. So what's happening is we have lots of other color options that are currently in use, and P3 is definitely one of them for digital cinema. Adobe RGB is that's the one where the green is the same as the NTSC, the original NTSC point. But if you look at the red and blue for Adobe, it's much better than NTSC. The original
NTSC. We can do that by zooming in to the lower left to see the blue. and the and or the lower right to see the red.
Yeah.
But
we'll get there.
We'll get there. Yeah. Okay, here we go.
Yeah. So you can see the green is the original NTSC, and then the Adobe RGB, the P3 in the blue in particular, the green line, not the green color, but the green line is the original NTSC points. So both all three, P3 709 and Adobe RGB all have better blues than the original NTSC points. And then, of course, when we look over at red, P3 has certainly has a better red than our NTSC point. And it has a better red than the original NTSC color as well.
I find this fascinating that the original specification of color for NTSC, which stands for National Television Systems Committee, which is the body that defined standard definition TV.
In 1953,
that those colors, that color gamut or color space is much larger than what we in fact use now for high definition. How did that happen?
Well, the space for color came about from trying to compete with the CBS mechanical color system that came in 1950. In 1950, we actually had color filters that rotated in front of a black and white TV set. So it was something called sequential color. You got red, then green, then blue. Oh, by the way, single chip DLP projectors emulate that and do the exact same thing where we have a rotating color filter wheel in front of a white light source and we get our colors of red, green, and blue. So we've come right back to that rotating color filter wheel in some of our viewing.
Yeah.
But the color space when we had color filter wheels was phenomenal. We could get really good color. So when the electronic color system came along, they felt they had to get really close to the color capability that you saw in the color filter wheel system. So they specified colors, and then when they went to try to create them in phosphors that went into a CRT, they found that they didn't work. When you have green, and I know this is beyond most of the people who are listening, but we used to have oscilloscopes, and the trace would go across, and of course the vertical represented the voltage and the horizontal represented time. But sometimes the things happened so fast that you actually wanted the phosphor to stay lit after the beam had crossed. And so they used green phosphors because green has a retentivity. You strike it with an electron beam and it stays lit long after that electronic beam is gone. Well, that's great when something happens so fast that you wouldn't see it if the green decayed instantly. But if you're trying to preserve something, so all of the original oscilloscopes had a green phosphor in them.
Right.
Well, so the color of green existed, but the problem was that when you lit up that green, it stayed lit. And so the action would move across the screen and the green was still lit over here. And so you had a comet tail as the motion passed across. So the green didn't work.
So the green phosphor hanging on is good for oscilloscopes, but bad for video displays.
That's correct. And then the red, in order to get that color of red, the drive current that was required to light that red up was very much higher than either the green or the blue. So if the red beam, it was called purity, if the red beam hit the blue or green phosphors, it would light them up like a Christmas tree. And you know, so So suddenly there would be glaring errors if the red beam accidentally hit a blue phosphor or a green phosphor, a green emitting phosphor or a blue emitting phosphor.
Yep.
So it didn't work. And in order to get the lag characteristics and the light output that everybody wanted, we ended up having to greatly reduce the size of the color triangle. And we ended up with SMPTE-C. And then when we went to HD, it got slightly bigger. And of course, when we went to P3 in digital cinema, we weren't using phosphors anymore. We were using light bulbs. So we didn't have the limitation of phosphors to worry about.
I mean, when we first went to HD, we still had phosphors because there were still a lot of phosphor-based, CRT-based TVs.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, they're gone. Plasmas are also phosphor-based. So it makes sense that the high-definition color triangle had to be roughly the same as the standard definition because it was based on phosphors. Now, of course, we're not based on phosphors anymore, and so we have a much greater latitude, right?
That is part of what opens up the discussion of now we can specify in this new television system that's coming along, we can specify a much larger color capability because we're no longer encumbered by what phosphors can do.
Right.
And that's opened up the floodgate to, oh, let's do everything. And of course, 2020 was somebody's idea of let's do everything. Unfortunately,
I was going to say, but even 2020 doesn't encompass the entire range of visible colors that we as humans can see. No triangle will do that, in fact, except if it extends outside of that visible range. I don't imagine you're saying that the TV sets should be able to reproduce colors that we can't, in fact, see so that we can see everything that we can see.
That's absolutely correct. But there's good reason behind that, that when we decided on the original color space, it was determined that there is no useful information unless light strikes a surface. If you think about it, if there isn't an edge or a surface or some object, there isn't a lot of useful information. To broadcast light alone is not useful. You need some edges and you need some definitions. So when a camera is shooting objects out in our room, we really only need to be concerned about transmitting surface colors.
Mm.
And the original NTSC, 1953 NTSC triangle, did encompass the majority of surface colors. So, you know, basically anything that we would photograph as an object could be conveyed in the color space.
Got it.
Now,
got it.
Now, the only time that you need a larger color space is if you're interested in transmitting the colors of light. Well, where would they come from?
You're talking about there the colors of emitted light, of objects
emitted
that
light.
Emit yes. light rather than reflecting mm-hmm. light.
That's correct. A surface, good point. A surface reflects light, and if we want to convey a space that's larger than surface color, it becomes an emitted color.
Right.
Now, those emitted colors absolutely exist. And if you go to Times Square or to Las Vegas or some places in Hollywood, you know where the neon signs are.
Right.
Neon is a really good example of emitting colors that are beyond surface colors. So in program production, the need to go outside the area of surface color would be contained in how often do you want to exactly reproduce what a neon light looks like, what its color is. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that isn't desirable. I'm just saying it is a tiny percentage of the kind of information we are normally used to seeing in program content.
Because if that makes any sense. It does, because the vast majority of what we see in program content is surface colors. It's light reflected off of surfaces.
That's correct. Yeah. So ideally, if I'm going to set a standard, I don't have to go out beyond surface colors unless it's convenient and free. Now, if it's convenient and free, keep in mind that this is a communication system, and whatever we set for a reference for a mass communication system has to be affordable.
Yep.
So I can't come up with some new plasma technology or something that is capable of generating light that's exceedingly expensive. That is not something that belongs to a mass communication system.
At least not, you might develop a prototype like that, but you have to have some sense that it's going to be able to be built for a mass communication system. I'm thinking particularly of the Dolby high dynamic range display prototype that they have built, which can do a lot more dynamic range than any current TV. But it requires two 220-volt feeds, and it's water-cooled. And, you know, it must have cost, you know, many, many tens of thousands of dollars to build. Hopefully we'll get there one day, but they're just trying to show what they can do.
You don't want to base a mass communication standard on something that's tens of thousands of dollars.
Right.
And so when we set standards of what we're using, we have to be practical in picking things that are affordable to a mass communication audience.
Right.
So there's always going to be limitations over what can be done versus what can be done affordably. There are going to be limitations.
Right. M5 in the chat room is asking, why not go full spectrum? Are there technical issues or production issues? And we've just covered a couple of them. I wanted to make sure that M5 knew that, you know, we were actually talking about that. There are technical issues because, you know, you need to set three colors and that forms a triangle, and there will be some colors that aren't displayed there. But there's also a practical issue of, you know, it's going to be too expensive. He also asks, what about using six colors, like as in new printers?
Yes. We are coming up on a UHD TV system, and everything is on the table for this new system. And there are actually discussions of making it a six-color system as opposed to a three-color system. It is initially a three-color system because we only see red, green, and blue. But
that's true. Our eyes only have red, green, and blue receptors.
That's correct. But if we're trying to enlarge the color space, if we do pick points for yellow, cyan, and magenta, then we could have a six-sided fixture rather than a three-sided fixture. And yes, we could include more color. So it's under discussion. That's a starting point. But I'd also have to tell you, in order for that to work, we'd have to start from scratch in producing program content. Because all of our program content up to this point has been produced in red, green, and blue.
Right.
So going forward, it's absolutely possible to have a six-color system. But we also have to create the six-color gathering device, the device that actually picks it up. Yes. The camera, the scanner, even in electronic production, certainly animation would be the first thing that could it could get there first,
right?
As an example. So there are actually lots of ways of getting there, but we haven't even started that one. So for the time being, I'd like to leave six colors off this discussion.
Yeah.
But if you've read any of the articles that I've written about UHD, the ultimate UHD system that I would like to have built would include an ability to have a six-color system.
If that helps
in answering the question, it has not been forgotten. It's not as if we're ignoring it. And incidentally, I'm going to drift a little bit off color,
so to speak.
I'm going to get off color for just a moment. don't know where that came from. But anyway, none of what we are talking about in UHD is going to be possible until we get connectivity. Until we can get this source, this six-color source, this higher resolution, higher bit depth, higher dynamic range, until we can get it from the source, whatever is creating content, all the way to the consumer, we don't have anything.
Right.
And so as much as we're talking about color here, I would like to emphasize that my priority in UHD is connectivity. And I want to develop a system in connectivity where it's big enough so we can dream about a six-color system, or we can dream about higher dynamic range, and the connectivity will just be there. So that aside, all these things that we're talking about, the connectivity doesn't exist to do those kinds of things. So
right. HDMI 2.0 is already too limited to convey the sorts of things that we are talking about and considering for this UHD system.
And even the codec, even the H.265 is way too limited to be doing any of this stuff. So as a caution to anybody who's saying, let's do six colors now, I'm going to say, I want the connectivity first. I want to be able to deliver it before we talk about it.
Yeah. Before we get into the Spectra, and we're going to be talking a lot about Spectra here in a minute, but Muchacho in the chat room is asking, and somebody else asked earlier too, UHD sets are being manufactured now, so isn't it too late to be talking about these sorts of things? And or will the UHD sets that are being made today become obsolete when these decisions are finally made?
The answer is they won't become obsolete if the ultimate UHD system is implemented. Since this is supposed to be about color, let me use just the example of color. And
please,
you can infer that dynamic range and everything else is included. But among the things that the ultimate UHD system should have as part of its capability is an ability to address all existing sets. So as an example, we would color correct to two or three color spaces. So in this connectivity that I just spoke of, we would actually send a 709 signal, a P3 signal, and possibly an Adobe RGB signal, something larger. So the studios would be faced with having to come up with three sets of color corrections, but all three of those sets could be included in the single connectivity. And then what would happen is the set would identify itself to the processor box that has the incoming signal. The set would say, I'm a 709 set and I need the 709 signal. So in our ultimate system, we are actually going to provide the option for multiple color spaces in the connectivity. And then even your 1080p set today that only has an HDMI 1.4 connection on it can participate in UHD because there will be something on UHD for it. Mm. Will the current UHD sets that are being sold now be obsolete? If somebody puts the UHD system together properly, the answer is no, they will never be obsolete. Well, never is a long time, but Certainly not in the foreseeable future. They won't be obsolete because there will be something in the connectivity coming down that knows that those sets exist and know that those sets have to be addressed.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Eric Duckman in the chat room is saying, define the, what are you talking about? Connectivity. What we're talking about is HDMI or DisplayPort or some other physical means of getting the signal from the source device in your home to the TV, and having enough smarts in both devices for the TV. HDMI already does this to a certain degree, for the TV to say to the device, I have this kind of color space capability. I have this kind of dynamic range capability, so on and so on. So hit me with what's appropriate for that. And the source device will say, oh, okay, I got just what you need. Boom, send it down the pipe.
Well, and my definition of connectivity is actually broader than that.
Okay.
My definition of connectivity starts at the source. It actually starts from the point that we capture information, an Arri Alexis camera or a Red camera or a Sony F55 or F65, whatever good camera that we're using to capture the source. Mm-hmm. We're capturing a huge world, a world that is much bigger than anything we can reproduce. Now, what I want in the ultimate connectivity, I want all of that information to be able to be conveyed directly to the consumer. So that if the camera captures a great big huge color space and you happen to have a set with a great big huge color space, well, you can take advantage of it because that's part of the connectivity. So everything that gets captured would be put in a container. Remember we talked about a container?
Yep.
A color space container? Well, it's not only this big container for color space, but it's a big container for high dynamic range, for anything you can imagine, maybe even six colors. But it's a container that could hold all the information you could possibly gather in the process of creating content, and it can convey it to the consumer. The entire container, everything that's in the container is going to go to the consumer.
If the consumer has the capability of receiving it and displaying it, it would require a lot of bandwidth. It would require a display of great capability. And I think what you're saying is if you have all of that, wonderful. You could display it all. You could see it all. But if you don't, it needs to get trimmed down somehow, right?
Okay. And yes, but that's part of what gets carried in the connectivity. I'm defining connectivity as everything from the camera source all the way to the consumer. The entire signal path from the source all the way to the consumer, to me, is connectivity.
Got it.
And so I want to know that the editing system is going to be able to contain all the information and preserve all the information so that if there is high dynamic range, it can contain the high dynamic range. So connectivity for me means all the way from the camera to the consumer and delivering everything to the consumer. Now, within that connectivity, you're going to have some specific color timed, high dynamic range timed material that will fit known specifications. And the people who create content can only be expected to provide a limited number of options in both color and high dynamic range. So as an example, I don't believe that they're going to want to provide any more than three sets of colors. 709.
If that.
Two would be better. Two would be easier because right now they have to do two. They have to do 709 and they have to do P3. So right now, everybody's set up to do two. And so that could be what comes down the pipe. Now, the fact that a larger space is in the pipe could mean that a manufacturer could build something with a bigger color space and get close to a usable picture. But it wouldn't be an ideal picture because there wouldn't be a human being involved in setting the conditions of what that picture should look like in that larger color space. So we could all, we could only approximate where we're supposed to go other than the fixed options that the studios would provide.
Okay.
Boy, is that a long-winded answer to the question. My apologies. I hope everyone followed that.
Oh, I think it's fine. I think it's fine, and I appreciate it very much. Now, the next part of our discussion has to do with spectra, the different amounts of red, green, blue, and all the colors in between, from various sources and from various displays, and how that relates to this whole color space issue. But if you'll give me just a moment before we get into that, and we got a lot of graphics to go through, which I think we can go through pretty quickly. Before we do, though, I want to let everybody know about something new that's happening at TWiT, which is actually quite exciting to me. Now, it has to do with Amazon. Now, most of us have shopped on Amazon. I certainly have many times. I'm an Amazon Prime member. I get lots of ebooks on Amazon and other stuff as well. You already know, of course, that the price, selection, and convenience of Amazon.com. And now you can even help support TWiT with your Amazon purchases. I think this is so cool. It's easy. All you do is click through the Amazon banner at twit.tv/Amazon and shop as usual. There's really no difference. It's as simple as that. It costs you nothing extra, and you can purchase, and anything you purchase helps keep the lights on at the Brick House, which is certainly a cause near and dear to my heart. As I said, I buy stuff on Amazon all the time. I recently actually purchased a book, an ebook for my iPad, written by my great aunt. About the chakra system, which is the mystical view of the human body with the chakra energy centers. She was quite involved in that, and she wrote a book about it. And I found it as an ebook on Amazon. It was great. There are tons of books, tons of movies. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you can get, there are thousands of titles you can get for free. There's a Amazon there. In fact, there are some picks on the Amazon, the TWiT landing page, which I was looking at a little earlier. And there's just bunches of stuff there. I can't find it off the top of my head. In fact, there's an Amazon banner on the right hand side of the screen. When you go to twit.tv/Amazon, all you have to do is, you know, click on that and shop away. It's really great. But whatever you buy, please make sure to click through the Amazon banner at twit.tv/Amazon. It's a very easy way to support TWiT. You can also bookmark that page and click through our link every time you shop there. There's even a link for Amazon UK and Canada, so we don't want you guys to feel left out. Once again, that's twit.tv/Amazon. And we thank you very much for your support. Okay, Joe, we're going to start talking about spectra here.
And we might go to the first diagram.
Let's do.
Okay, yes. Oh, this is helpful. All right. What you're looking at is what sunlight looks like. I actually put an 18% gray card out in my backyard and photographed it with a spectroradiometer. And so some sunny afternoon here in Los Angeles, that's what the sun looked like. You can see that it's a fairly continuous spectrum. You can see the ultraviolet going off. And of course, as it goes off in the red direction, you can see that there's a lot of infrared that's called heat. And so there's a huge amount of infrared and not quite as much ultraviolet. But basically, the light source that we use to see surfaces is fairly continuous. So that any property in the surface that will reflect a particular color, there is a color there to be reflected.
Right.
Okay. So in our human visual system, the sun has a high color rendering index. The sun has an ability to render colors visible to you. And you can see why, looking at the sun, that it pretty much covers everything kind of equally.
Yes.
And if we go to the next slide, this is a fluorescent bulb. And you can see the fluorescent bulb has spikes in it.
Serious spikes.
Yeah, conveniently red, green, and blue.
Now, that's a D65 fluorescent bulb,
yes,
which is the same color of white that we strive to achieve on video displays.
Yes. And this particular bulb is said to have a high color rendering index, meaning that there is energy at every single color, so that if that fluorescent bulb is shining on any kind of a surface, whatever color reflecting capability the surface has will show up. Of course, red, green, and blue will show up just a little bit better than the rest of the colors. But anything within a surface being lit by this bulb will show up. So yeah, it has a color rendering index. This particular bulb has a color rendering index of something like 96% or 98%. Can't remember the bulb I used, but
whereas the sun, would we call that 100%?
Yeah, that's a close enough. Good analogy. That's a good analogy.
And we also have an incandescent bulb, which I thought was a very interesting pattern as well. Look at that.
Now, has anybody ever noticed that an incandescent bulb is orange? And right there it is. And
there you can see why.
Yes. And if you think about it, blues are not anywhere near as easily seen under incandescent lighting because the light is orange, and therefore blue surface colors are much more difficult to see. But the bulb, the incandescent bulb, is still said to have a high color rendering index because there's nothing left out of the spectrum. There is at least light at almost every color in the spectrum. So
even though blue is very low.
Yes, even though blue is very low, it is said, the bulb is said to have a good color rendering index.
Okay.
All right. Now, we're going to go to TV sets from this. I think we are.
The first one up is Simpty C.
Yes. Now, this is what the phosphors in a Simpty C monitor look like. And now, granted, there weren't a lot of Simpty C monitors on the consumer market, but and this happens to be a professional monitor that I used in photographing this. But you can see that there's two spikes in red. There's actually two spikes in green, and then there's a fairly smooth blue area. Mm-hmm. Now, the color fidelity out of this set not only was limited by the fact that the triangle was small, but there's not some energy, or there's huge variations in energy across the spectrum.
Right.
Now, if we go to the DLP projector, this is my DLP projector.
Which now, is, by the way, your DLP projector was made by Samsung. You consulted on it and made it happen. Samsung, unfortunately, didn't have its marketing act together, and so it didn't really get out in the market as much as those of us who have seen it wish it had, because it's really a wonderful projector.
The interesting thing for me in this projector, now the colors of red, green, and blue are the same at the Simpty C. In fact, it can do Simpty C or EBU or 709. But the spectrum is much more continuous in this than it is in a CRT.
Yeah.
And when colorists started using my projector to color correct, the first thing they told me, gee, the color fidelity is a lot better. I can see things in pictures I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And they really felt that this device provided them with much better color fidelity and much, they could finesse the pictures much better. They could get more of what they wanted out of the pictures when the canvas, the screen, was lit by this light as opposed to the light from the CRT.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we move forward in those diagrams, we will get to, the next one?
That's okay. The next one.
Okay, well, the next one. All right, this is what...
Did you want to see S9 first? Those are different. Those yeah.
Later. Yeah. Okay. All right. The diagram that's there is what the 2020 color space would look like. The points in 2020 are right out at the edge of the CIE diagram, and they are single wavelengths. And this is an emulation because we don't yet have a display that is doing this. But knowing that you have to be right out on the edge of the CIE diagram, which means single wavelength, what I did is I drew what they would look like. This is a drawing. It's an emulation. This is not an actual spectral response because we don't yet have a lot of displays that will do 2020.
Right. But the interesting thing, when we do, they will look sort of like this.
Yes.
That's the nature of 2020, is that each color of red, green, and blue is a single wavelength. It is not a combination of a bunch of different wavelengths. It's a single wavelength like a laser, which is why they're talking about lasers being the light source, ultimately the best light source for 2020 display.
System. Yes.
Yes.
And now we start talking about, do you remember how I told you the color fidelity is better with a broader spectrum than it was with the narrow spectrum of the CRT? Well, here we have a much narrower spectrum. Now, with this spectrum, we can hit every other point in the diagram. There is no question that in combining red, green, and blue, we can hit every other color. The problem is that human beings see color differently. Can we go back one slide?
Sure.
If a color is covered by a very broad spectrum, we are all going to agree on what the color is. Can we go forward?
Yep.
If a color is covered by a single point, none of us are going to agree on what that color is.
Isn't that weird?
And
that the human visual system, if you have a spectrum like this, like what we're seeing now from your projector, which is very broadband, and you show a particular color of red or green or cyan or whatever, most of us will look at that and say, that's a particular color.
Yes.
But if we represent the colors by these single wavelength red, green, and blue, all of a sudden, different people are going to see different colors. That is the weirdest darn thing.
The word is metamerism. And
don't be scared, folks. Metamerism is a weird word, but that's the word that describes that effect.
It describes the fact that we don't each see color the same way.
Right.
So if we are handed a very narrow bandwidth of color, we are each going to see it slightly different. If we're handed a wide bandwidth, since every color around the area that we see is covered, then we all recognize it as the same color.
Mm.
So the broad bandwidth actually is critical to getting agreement in what we see. Now, in a mass communication system, the idea is that everybody has the opportunity to see the same color.
Right, exactly. And we want to assure that everybody sees more or less the same color, because that's what the colorists and the director and the cinematographer all we're very careful about is shooting a scene, shooting a movie or a TV show or whatever, and having the colors be a certain way and represented in a certain way. And it seems kind of self-defeating that if you then send that to a TV wherein me and my wife will look at this and say, I might say, wow, that looks great. And she might say, oh, the colors are off.
Looks weird.
It looks weird. It's a very strange fluke of human experience that I find fascinating. But it's one reason why we may very well not want to use this 2020 color space.
Right. Now, if you remember back in the CIE diagram, the 2020 space was quite a bit larger than any of the other colors that we're currently using, whether it's Adobe, RGB, there you go. You can see the 2020 is on the outside. And so it's larger than the other colors. Among the things that are being proposed is that the 2020 color space would become a container.
Ah, that would not, though, be the final space that would get delivered.
Right. It would just contain the information that gets delivered.
As you were talking about earlier in the show.
That's correct. So we could be using 2020 as a specification. Now, there are a number of people who are saying there were two other triangles that are much larger than 2020 that have been in common use for a number on the prior diagram.
The prior diagram, the number one diagram actually.
Diagram one, yes.
There it is.
There are a number, yes. And those larger color spaces are carriers. And so there are a number of people who are saying, but we're already using a carrier. Why do we need a new one?
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of people are proposing that we just use our existing carriers and that we don't assign a new carrier to this ultra high definition system, that we just use carriers that already exist.
Right.
So that's part of the debate of where color could be going.
Mm-hmm.
But
I will say that that I have a guy from DCI, Digital Cinema Initiative, scheduled to come on in a few weeks to talk about the system called ACES, A-C-E-S, which is in part to do with this carrier system.
And that's actually where a lot of my positions are coming from. ACES in production carries all of the information, or at least it can be set up to carry all of the information. And the reality is, in the future, when we want to do something that we may not have even imagined today, if the connectivity is that ACES system, is that big carrier, then it really doesn't matter what we come up with in the future. The connectivity is already there. And so dream on. Do anything you would like to do. And in 20 years, we may be doing significantly different things. And I'm saying, dream on. Go ahead. Do it. And yeah. I want a connectivity that will get us anything we want to do. And so that's where it's where I'm coming down on the connectivity. I would prefer that we just stick with the carrier we're using now. We have lots of experience with it. I don't want to mess with converting from one carrier to another. I don't want to mess the post-production system up by introducing yet another way of doing something. Mm-hmm. I would just rather they use the tools they're already using to create content, just deliver everything to us.
And then let us take care of how is that going to actually be displayed.
Yes. Let the set determine what it's capable of doing and pick out of the carrier what it needs to produce a picture.
Mm-hmm. That seems to me, though, that then you would not end up with the director's intent, if you will, or the cinematographer's intent. Because if you send that carrier with all the color that was captured down to a set that's only capable of 709 or even P3, the colors are going to come out different than they were in that carrier.
But what is also going to happen in the carrier is, as happens in digital cinema and 709, the carrier carries the information. But inside that carrier are specific things for SMPTE-C, for 709, for P3. They're all inside the carrier.
As metadata?
Yes. And so there is something called an output display transform. So we know what's coming down the carrier, and we know that the set is a 709 set. And so there is an output display transform that takes the entire carrier and delivers a 709 signal.
This was under the director's or the cinematographer's control. They knew what was going to happen, or they know what's going to happen when that happens.
That's correct. And it's included in the carrier.
Gotcha.
See, this carrier carries everything, including instructions on how to get it right in 709 or P3 or eventually in high dynamic range or anything else that you would like to do. Mm-hmm. Instructions to get it right will be included in the carrier.
Got it. All right.
So I see it as a really fantastic system in that the sets that are out there today will still be fully functional. They won't be cast off. They'll still be perfectly usable. In addition, the sets that you bought before UHD ever came out would be useful on the UHD system. Keep in mind that they actually have a capability that is, the sets themselves have a capability of reproducing a far better signal than we're transmitting in this 8-bit 420 system that's called MPEG.
We
currently use MPEG to compress our signal. And MPEG limits what we can convey. It turns out that the majority of TV sets that are on the market today can do more than what is conveyed by that MPEG signal. Uh-huh. So if the new carrier could bring along a better signal, it turns out that today's sets, something that has an HDMI, say 1.3 or 1.4 connection, could actually take advantage of parts of a better signal. And if a better signal is put into the set, there is a strong possibility that there would be a better picture to come out. And therefore, that set could truly represent ultra-high definition. It might not be everything that ultra-high definition can do, but UHD would bring something to it that would make it better. Therefore, in my opinion, those sets would be included in the ultra-high definition system. Not only do I not want this new UHD set to go out of usefulness, I also don't want your existing 1080p sets to go out of usefulness.
Mm. 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 This is a grand vision that I love to know that, you know, the TV that people are buying today, either HD or UHD, will continue to be useful in the future. I had sort of had a different take on it, but I'm understanding what you're saying. And I think if we can this is the real crux of it, isn't it? If we can end up making the UHD system as you describe it in this show, then we won't have obsolescence in a couple of years.
That's correct. And we will create a connectivity that can keep us going for at least the next 20 years. But at the same time, we aren't going to obsolesce anything beyond a particular level. I really do think that the set's going to have at least an HDMI connection, that sort of thing. Your old CRT sets are truly dead. Mm. And
for 50 years. They had a good run.
But there's a limit to how far back I want to go.
Right.
in creating a new system, there's a limit to how backward compatible I think we need to be.
Yeah.
And given the sales of TV sets with HDMI connections on them, how high they are, and the percentage of penetration of the market these sets have, I think it's safe to say I only need to go back as far as HDMI 1.3.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I can convey a better signal across an HDMI 1.3 connection, then I can make those sets look better than with the current signal that's going into them.
Well, as someone here in the chat room said, from your mouth to the manufacturer's ears.
We hope. Absolutely, yes. We hope.
Well, I know that you're doing a lot of work with the manufacturers, or some of them anyway, and yes. Also with SMPTE and various other bodies. And I really, really, really hope that what you're talking about is taken to heart and really implemented, because you know, we're at a cusp right now. We're at a tipping point of a brand new TV system. And if it's done right,
we have an opportunity.
Yes, exactly.
And the thing that gets me, all the pieces to do this are in place. You'll be talking about the ASUS system coming up. So everything in production is ready to go. The connectivity is in the production.
Yep.
So all we need is the connectivity from the production to the consumer. And pieces of that exist now. The processing horsepower to do it exists now. As an example, the processing horsepower in PS4, right now, today, something you could buy off the shelf, the processing power that's in that is more than enough to see us through the new vision for connectivity. So a large number of pieces exist and are already on the market, either in the professional world or the consumer world. So I'm not suggesting something that can't be done. I know better than to do that. I'm just picking things that already exist and putting them together.
Yeah.
And saying, this is what we need to aim at as our connectivity. And I emphasize connectivity is the most important part of UHD. Everything else is just up to our dreams.
Well, we will continue to dream then, and hopefully they will come to fruition as you suggest. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of a fascinating hour. I thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's Joe Kane, of course. He's been on the show many times, and I'm sure will be many times again, because he is just a font of useful geekery. And you can find out more about what he's doing at his website, videoessentials.com. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. And you can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Rob Aubrey of Sony, and we're going to be talking about Sony's initiative called Pure Audio, in which high-resolution audio files are distributed on Blu-ray discs. It sort of harkens back to the CD, but with higher quality audio. So we've been talking a lot about high-res audio on AVS Forum, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Rob about it. So I do hope you will join us. Until then, geek out.